Now, Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
All right, we're back on the air here at CFAX 1070. I got a text actually about 16 minutes ago during our segment with Legally Speaking. I think it's a good way to set the tone of our next segment as we try to examine and understand what is happening out there in the wide world in terms of the global economy and supply chains is a term that many of you are hearing more and more often. The text is short, but it's poignant. It says, Adam, how do you sleep at night with this pending economic doom? Do you have any information that can comfort those who are not concerned about contracting or spreading this virus as they are able to self-isolate but are greatly concerned about the economic impacts? Texter, I sleep at night the same way that I always do, which is usually with some degree of difficulty. I have problems turning off my brain. My thoughts continue racing around my head when I'm conscious and when I'm trying to lose consciousness to get a few hours sleep so I can be as fresh as I can to get up and do my job again the next day. I try to focus on things I can change. And I try to allow my brain to forget, at least for the moment, about things that I cannot change. And I try to remember the old prayer. Now, I don't mean in the literal sense for those of you who are not of the religious type, which is fine. But it's the old prayer is grant me the strength to deal with the things that I can, the grace to accept the things that I cannot change, and the wisdom to tell between the two. And again, that's something that all of us are trying our best to do. But yeah, just focus on what you can do. Do it to the best of your ability. Then do it again, just to make sure it's done right. And then do your best to forget about the things you cannot change at this time, because they will work themselves out one way or the other. So in terms of the global economy, what is actually happening out there? What the heck is a supply chain? And why are we expecting these impacts to persist for the time being into the future, months if not years in some cases, absent government intervention? Professor Werner Antweiler is our guest. He is an expert on these and other matters, a voice to whom we have turned in the past to help better understand these things. He is the chair of international trade policy with UBC Sutter School of Business. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
Good morning, Adam.
What is a supply chain? When we use that term, when the Prime Minister uses that term, what's he talking about?
Yeah, that's basically the fact that all the products we use are produced in multiple stages, so not just in one factory, but there are actually multiple factories involved, all spread across the globe. So, for example, when we hold a smartphone in our hand, well, there is a microchip in there, there is a screen in there, there is all kinds of gear that is manufactured in different plants and different locations that all has to come together and make a product. And in the last number of years, companies have become really good at extending the supply chain, making it longer, making it more complex, and making it also more vulnerable. So when we have a situation like today where there are disruptions, they're going to ripple to the whole system. So if there's one piece missing in our smartphone, it can be produced because we depend on that one critical piece. And that is really what is the Achilles heel of the modern supply chain. We have become so good at making complex things that we have also become so much more vulnerable.
So if we say a smartphone, and I'm holding one in my hand right now, it's an Apple brand. That's not a promotion. That just happens to be what it is. It's a very common brand. Many folks have them. It'll have the information that goes into designing it is done by Apple in California. The actual manufacturing of it is a firm called Foxconn in Shenzhen, China. The elements of the batteries, the rare earth minerals, would likely have been refined, if not extracted and refined, in China. Many of the raw materials coming from wherever they can be sourced at the given time at the most efficient price. All of these things wind their way around the world to be produced and to put into one physical item, which is then shipped to me where I bought it once upon a time. Now, help our audience understand, Professor, why are these chains so long? Why can't everything all come from the same place, be built in the same place, and be sold to people who live right near that place?
Yeah, it's all about specialization. So there are companies that are really specialized in doing one thing well. There are the companies that make the batteries. There are the companies that make the microchip. There are the companies that make the glass that goes into the material. There are basically a whole lot of very specialized companies that are all particularly efficient in with the one location they're doing this. And often they only have one plant. So there's basically vulnerability simply because these particular items have to be produced to scale, and you can only do that really well if you do it in a single plant. And of course, if there's a disruption to that one plant, it's going to ripple to the whole system. And I think that's what we're seeing when first the coronavirus started in China. Certain plants were shut down there. And then, of course, these supplies are maybe missing somewhere else in the supply chain. So it all gets basically carried through the entire system as one plant is experiencing a slowdown or a shutdown, it will affect the next plant in that supply chain.
Now, China, as you mentioned, is integral to many supply chains around the world right now. My understanding is that a perfect example would be rare earth minerals and for electronic components, as well as other things for high-efficiency batteries and whatnot. How did China get this way? Is it just a function of how large it is with 1.4 billion people?
Well, it's always a matter of cost. Now, companies decide where to produce based on cost considerations. Sometimes there are other things that matter, such as raw materials and availability, but essentially China has become the assembly line for a lot of products because in part its size, it's a large country that has a lot of capacity to produce. Sometimes it's a specialization too in certain industries where they have become super critical. But a lot of components also come from elsewhere, from Japan, from South Korea, from a whole lot of different countries.
Yes.
That all come to that one final point in a factory in Shenzhen where it's getting assembled and then shipped to consumers somewhere else. So it's all this alignment that has made it more vulnerable. And many companies are now struggling with this situation where they have not enough resilience in the supply chain. And that is a concept that we teach at business schools. How do we make supply chains not just efficient, but also resilient? And there's a trade-off. You can be super efficient and cut costs, but then you become more vulnerable because you don't have slack capacity, you don't have a slack inventory to deal with disruptions. So how do we deal with high-impact, low-probability events? And that requires essentially companies providing some redundancy in their system and also some more flexibility in the system, as well as making some cultural changes within their company that allows them to make decisions when the going gets tough, that basically they empower teams to make decisions at the local level rather than having a very centralized decision-making system that is very inflexible. So it all comes down to redundancy and flexibility to make supply chains more resilient.
All right. I want to take a quick break, and then I want to talk about how finance works in all of this. Ladies and gentlemen, and I know our guest will help us understand this, a lot of trade on this planet moves on what is known as letter of credit transactions. What the heck does that mean, and how does that play into all of this? We'll have our expert guest help us understand in just a moment.
Keeping you informed, Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
International trade, supply chains, letter of credit transactions, complicated terms. How do they work and what do they mean in terms of our global supply chains, our ability to continue to access the goods that we need? Werner Antweiler helping us understand this. He's professor and chair of international trade policy, UBC Sauder School of Business. When we talk about paying for things, Werner Antweiler, if I am here and there's a company in China, I'm not going to stuff a bunch of dollar bills in an envelope and mail it away. I'm going to use another tool to facilitate that transaction and that payment. How does that work?
You know, it's really all about trust. We have to make sure that when we send goods as an exporter, that the importer is going to pay us the money, like maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks, or 4 weeks from now. And so we need to actually have an intermediary, a bank, that's guaranteeing the payment. And that works through something called the letter of credit system. That means when an importer orders goods, they have to get a bank to guarantee that the money will flow in the end. And that is kind of like a line of credit. It's never really used in most instances, but if there is a disruption, then it kicks in as a loan. And that means banks have to have enough liquidity to make it happen. That's something we call the dash for cash. That means when there is a major disruption in the system, the banks have to be able to provide that liquidity to the exporters to keep things moving. Because when we get goods, there's always another transaction behind it, which is the money that's being paid for it. And this is what's really critical. If the banks cannot provide liquidity, we're going to have trade seizing up, and that would be a catastrophe. So we have to make sure that the financial system keeps operational to support all the physical goods movement that we need to see happening.
What is a repo market?
Yeah, essentially that is a market for getting the banks to get enough liquidity. That is, the central banks actually have to be able to provide enough money to the system to keep working. And this is some type of instrument that is used by the banks to make sure that this is happening. But essentially, it really means when we have a liquidity crunch, the central bank has to be able to put in money into the system so that the banks can refinance themselves because they have to get that access to liquidity.
What happened recently with this $2.5 trillion worth of repo operations? What does that mean, and how much money actually went where?
Yeah, so basically the central banks can intervene in that market by buying up enough instruments so that that in turn provides and injects liquidity into that market. And that is essentially buying up bonds from banks in certain overnight transactions that allow them to inject that money that the banks have the cash that they can now make available to the exporters again. So this is really what's necessary, and these are staggering amounts of money, because you have to keep in mind that a lot of the trade transactions amount to trillions of dollars of currency transactions as well. Yes. Every day.
Now, you mentioned the term overnight. I think that it's important for our audience to understand, with these massive amounts of money being injected into the markets for liquidity, I've heard some people liking them will say, well, the government could have given every man, woman, and child a check for $1,000 or something like that. I say, no. It would be like the government giving every man, woman, and child a loan for $1,000 that they have to repay tomorrow morning, right?
Yeah, exactly like this. So essentially, this is overnight money. This is essentially allowing banks to make sure that they can deal with their cash flow. And that is, of course, varying dramatically when we have a crisis situation. In a normal situation, there is a certain amount that we can predict will be required. But when everything goes sideways, like we have in a situation right now, we suddenly need a lot more liquidity because the pattern for trade, for demand has changed dramatically. And so to make sure the system works, we have to inject that liquidity. And at a later point, we can take it out again. But right now, that money has to go into the system.
All right. So we've got U.S. liquidity. Now, I've said, and I know that you mirror this, and you explain it a lot better than I do, being the expert, but we are not so much facing a problem in terms of a lack of physical goods and inputs for products. We're facing the problem of, in that moment, when the transaction needs to happen, the payment needs to be made, we're facing a lack of an availability to borrow money for a few hours or for a day just to facilitate that transaction, and you'll get paid back when all is said and done. But if that loan isn't there, that loan isn't there. So how important is maintaining liquidity, as you put it?
Yes, it's really a kind of the grease that really keeps the whole system working. And if that somehow seizes up, then we have a ripple effect that essentially affects the physical production and distribution as well. And we don't want to see that. We want to avoid that at all costs. So to make sure that the system works, the central banks actually need to stand by to provide that liquidity to the banks that then can, again, extend the loans to the exporters and importers who carry out the actual physical transactions. And this is really what we don't see in terms of the international trade, but it's sort of the essential element without which nothing works. And this is the Achilles heel also of the system, because if that system freezes up, then nothing else moves, because without money, there's no trade.
Yeah, because I'm not going to send you, $1 billion worth of goods and whatnot if I don't know for sure that you're going to pay me. And if you can't get a bank to guarantee your promise to pay me, then I don't want to be left holding the bag in case something goes sideways. So I'm not going to give you the goods. And we have this ripple effect, as you mentioned.
Precisely.
All right. I want to ask you about missing supplies and how big of an issue they are at this time in the supply chain, as well as how that may change in future.
Yeah, so essentially we have some disruptions to production in various locations because factories are shut down for some time.
Yes.
First thing is in China, and obviously it was car manufacturers here in North America that are shutting down for 2 weeks. And of course, whenever we have a shutdown in production of a supplier or somebody along the supply chain, then that has an immediate rub-on effect on the companies further down the supply chain, because they may require these supplies if they don't have enough inventory. So they may have to curtail production. And this ripple effect will go through the whole system. That can actually percolate through the system for various months, actually, even until the end of the year, given the situation right now, because not everybody has enough supplies to meet production needs at this point. This is the result of making supply chains really lean, minimizing inventory. And that, unfortunately, has made companies particularly vulnerable to these disruptions.
What are you watching most closely in terms of these potential bottlenecks at this time?
Yeah, I'm looking at the locations where things are shutting down, because some manufacturers are in these very specific locations that are only producing there. China, of course, is super critical because it's sort of at the end of the supply chain for many high-tech goods. We also see now actually South Korea being actually very very much getting on top of the situation, so we don't really expect disruptions for critical supplies in the high-tech supply chains from South Korea or Japan, for that matter. But now we're seeing, of course, North America getting the towards these restrictions and output in mobility that could affect trade, and here it's the lack of mobility of trade that could become a problem. The border to the United States remains open for commercial traffic, even though it has been closed for non-essential travel. But it's really critical to keep the border open for the movement of the supplies and goods that we need to keep production running in Canada and the United States, both ways. So I'm looking very nervously at the border issues and making sure that we keep the border open for commerce.
Absolutely. And I saw actually a former public official here in Canada on Twitter the other day remind folks that I think it was about half of our medical devices that we import into Canada actually come from the United States of America. So we want that border open, and we want goods to continue to flow, particularly if we're going to need more medical devices in the near future, which I suspect we will.
Yes, it's not just medical devices, but it's also, of course, food supplies.
Yes.
Because a lot of them actually are imported from the United States, and as well, they're going the other way. So it's really critical that we make sure that commercial activity across the border remains feasible. We have to, of course, take all precautions for making sure that it doesn't spread the virus, but that can be done. So I think many people at the Canada Border Services Agency will be working exactly on that, making sure that there are no disruptions to commercial activities while making sure that the border remains closed for non-essential travel.
I want to say thank you very much for your knowledge and your insight. As always, Werner Antweiler is a professor and chair of international trade policy at UBC Sauder School of Business. Thank you for helping us understand these extremely complicated matters. Anything else you'd like to touch on before we wrap up?
Yeah, so the next weeks are going to be critical. We have to see if there are any more closures of production facilities. If it's only finished goods, say, in the car manufacturing sector because of assembly lines and close proximity of workers there, that is a relatively minor problem. But if it touches on other issues, for example, the food supply, where seasonal workers cannot come to Canada for harvesting products from the fields, that is going to be a more critical issue. So we will see very closely what will happen in terms of output that may fall as a result.
Werner Antweiler, thank you so much for your time. We'll let you get back to work.
My pleasure.
All right, have a great day. Bye now. There we go, folks. He is an expert in international trade. In fact, he's chair of international trade policy at UBC Sauder School of Business, helping us understand these. And again, it is important to remember at this time that the problem is not a lack of real goods. The problem is a lack of, well, words on paper, promises to pay, enforceable promises to pay, banks with enough liquidity in them to facilitate those transactions. The good news, ladies and gentlemen, is those sorts of problems are the problems that governments literally can solve with the stroke of a pen. See, governments are the ultimate insurers of transactions being made and of payments being made, because they, of course, are responsible for ensuring the legitimacy of fiat currencies in the first place. Their fiat just means decree or order, so they can order that currency either exists or doesn't exist, is valid or invalid, and that's just basically how the entire system works. So when these problems crop up, and the problem is just, we've got the people to put it together, we've got the parts, I've got my box of inputs over there, and I'd love to ship you these things, but I need somebody to say that you will pay me, even if that money's not in your bank account because something goes sideways. If the government steps in and goes, yeah, we'll insure that transaction. All right, let's get everybody to work. Let's do this stuff. I know I'm not going to be left holding the bag because the government is going to be there to ensure that I get paid. Those sorts of supply chain problems, we call it liquidity, that access of those funds, that guarantee that the payment will happen. Governments can solve that with a stroke of a pen, and they are. And that's a good thing, because governments cannot will goods into existence. You cannot say, I'm going to make a lot of more, everybody gets a respirator. Well, that's great. Or are you going to get 330 million respirators for all of the United States? They don't exist. Doesn't matter who puts words on paper. That can't actually be fixed that way. on the other hand, you can say, I need a guaranteed transaction for everybody here so I can make these respirators. Governments go, yeah, absolutely. Here's your guarantee. I don't know. We'll make sure payment happens. Payment's just words on paper. That's what we do. We're the government. They're doing their jobs at the moment, and they're doing it right. Now, if they don't, they're going to get a lot of criticism. But I like what I see so far. I want to warn everybody, though, this is just the beginning. We're going to run up so much debt getting out of this. But you know what? Folks are going to live. They're going to live because of the sacrifices we're all making. Nobody gets left behind. This is worth it. Quick break. News is next.